Greetings, class. This is Humanities 1. We're in the spring of the year. We're in the early Middle Ages. And we're at the point that many of you have desired to get to, which is Beowulf. And I'm going to introduce this early Anglo-Saxon epic today, and it'll be your assigned reading for the next class period, as well as a 400-word retelling of this epic poem, as well as writing an Anglo-Saxon poem. So before I do, let's just review a little bit. We started this spring term speaking about Augustine of Hippo. We kind of liked his town name. And Augustine of Hippo, if you remember, was a slave to his desires, to his lusts, until the silent word of God set him free. And he was always intrigued by that. So what set him free was not his own will, ultimately, but the will of God. And yet, sometimes he affirms that we do have choice and freedom. And so, can you explain, it's my first question, can you explain the difference between Augustine saying against the Manichees, we have free will, but then against the Pelagians, we do not have free will? Can you solve that paradox? And if you remember, in our lecture, in our lesson, we talked about, as created, we have free will. We are not animals that just operate on instinct. We make choices. But as fallen, as sinners, our will is bent in its choosing, even. Where theoretically, I could say, I could love that person, but in practice, I just can't love her or love him. It's not because we're not made like the angels and like, you know, rational beings that have choice and can choose to do good or to do bad. We know that theoretically I could envision myself loving anybody, but in practice we find ourselves unable. And it's that in moral inability, not a natural, but a moral inability, that Christ corrects through salvation. And it's what Augustine himself experienced when God set him free from his addictions. That's a power. And so if you've never experienced that power, I pray that you experience that power of deliverance. If the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed, Jesus said. Now, how about Patrick? Let's review here. If you remember, he's not Irish. And he's not Roman Catholic. He has Catholic forms, but he's not tied to Rome. He's from the church in Britain. He's even disowned by the church in Britain. He's a man of one book, the Bible, and he thought he was fulfilling the Great Commission. Do you remember why he thought he was fulfilling the Great Commission? Do you remember why he was so self-conscious about himself? Why you might say he had an inferiority complex. If not, go back and review your notes and see what made Patrick tick and what gave him such excitement about his work in Ireland. We've had three periods, time periods of the church: patristic era, the medieval era, and the modern era. We're in the medieval era right now, and we saw last time that there's three key individuals within the church: the Pope, the king, and then outside the church, Mohammed. And so the Pope is leader within the church, Pope at Rome. The kings, Holy Roman Emperor in particular, they clash and go back and forth, as we saw with Gregory the VII and Henry the IV. And then Mohammed, the leader of the Islamic kind of movement that then takes over North Africa and pushes into Europe, even takes over Spain. So this leads us to the Middle Ages, and we're going to kind of depart from the continent and move over to England. And so you have before you a chart that is by Bruce Metzger showing the Indo-European languages. And I want you to have that chart in front of you right now so that you can see all the family of languages in Europe. Find English. Can you find it? Okay. What's its closest relative? In other words, the language closest to us, to it. Probably not one you're familiar with, right? Frisian is the language closest to English, apparently, according to this chart. Metzger was an excellent scholar. I don't doubt him. Now notice, let's go to some cousins. There's cousins on the one side up in Scandinavia, Swedish, Danish, Norwegian, and then there's cousins on the other side, Dutch and German. And so when I learned German in high school, it became very apparent to me that these two languages are similar. If I point to my nose, it's Nase in German. My mouth is Mund. My eyes is Auge. My ear is Ohr. My arm is Arm. And my hair is Haar. All those basic Germanic words are the same pretty much in English as well as German. One of my favorite verbs is schlagen, which means to hit. We get the English word slug. And so, our language of English then has its roots in German, in the Germanic languages of Northern Europe. And so, we were conquered. England, when I say we, English-speaking peoples, you may have emigrated to America and listening to this, all of us, unless you're Native American, came at some point here. And so the language that is spoken in this country, English, is actually about, I'm told, 80% Latin because of William the Conqueror taking over in the Middle Ages from France. And so the French overlords brought a lot of the Latin words, a lot of Latin-based words, though there were some already present because of the Roman Empire and things like that in its legacy. All that to say is, in its basic form, English is Germanic, and the language that you're going to look at in Beowulf is Anglo-Saxon or Old English. But that's the English before the Norman conquest brought those Latin words in. And when we pick up the copy of Beowulf, and we will in just a little bit, and look on the other side of it, half the page on the left is the Anglo-Saxon in Seamus Heaney's translation of it, you can hardly read it. It's so weird. It'd be like learning a foreign language, even though it's the basis of your own, because it's that Old English part, that Germanic part that you're actually seeing. Now, before we do and leave this chart, I want to point out something even more, though. What's the farthest away relative of English that you find on the chart? Notice Celtic languages are on the chart. Irish, Scottish, Welsh, Old British, which is Patrick himself. That's part of this family of languages. Greek is part of it even. Latin is part of it. But the farthest away are actually in the upper left, aren't they? Bengali and Hindi. Kurdish, Afghan, modern Persian, all from the middle of Asia, the Indian subcontinent and Iran, Persian and Indian. That's why it's Indo-European, and it shows that the Germanic tribes that settled in Northern Europe, and even the Celtics, which settled before them, had migrated apparently at some point from Central Asia. That's why those peoples are called Caucasian. The Caucasus Mountains are in the middle of Asia. And so the people of India and of Afghan and Persia and such, modern day Iran, speaking Farsi, those people, if you look at them, their facial features are very similar to Europeans. And even their language structure is similar to the structure of the languages in Europe. This is very different than, now, their skin is darker due to being near the equator and those in up there in Sweden and Norway don't need to be have as much melanin in their skin to protect against the ultraviolet rays of the hot sun. But if you look at the structure of languages, Hebrew and Arabic, which are Semitic languages, I believe, but they're very close. Their vocabulary overlaps a lot, like English and German. Their language structure is very different. In Hebrew, the fundamental verb structure is on causation. So your cal stem would say something like learn, and then in the piel stem, it will say it means cause to learn. So lamad and then lamed. In the form lamed, cause to be in a state of learning means to teach. In English and German, you get a different word. Greek, you get a different word. The Indo-European languages apparently use a different word completely. But Hebrew, because its verb structure goes on causality, cause something, it can reuse the same word and just change the form. It's very versatile in that way. So to bring is to cause to return. So there's one word, shuv, return, and then in the hefil, cause to return, would be translated bring, or bring back. There is no similarity between that causative verbal structure and the Indo-European structure. Those are very different. And this, I think, is testimony to the Tower of Babel, where God confused the languages. And so there's original languages, our mother tongue. All those that are on the chart are due to one mother tongue, probably at the Tower of Babel. And as people spread out, they begin to not understand each other well. And eventually those dialects became their own languages, kind of like dogs become their own breeds if you separate them out. And so the larger family is due to spreading out in the earth, which is what God's purpose was in dividing up the tongues, that they would spread out. The peoples would spread out. But I don't believe there is one mother tongue for all the languages of the earth that would account for all of them. You run into a dead end due to these verbal structures, and that's testimony, marvelous agreement with the Tower of Babel and what God had done at that point. Okay, now turn to the map of England. The map, actually, it would be of Britain. And so if you look at the island of Britain and look in the different time periods, as you move from the time when it was under the Romans, Britannia, to the time of Alfred the Great in the 9th century, if you look to the left, you'll find Cambria or Wales. That's where Patrick came from. And so where modern-day Wales is, somewhere along there, and got kidnapped and brought over to Ireland, which is a little bit on the far left of the maps. But notice on the right, you will find in the upper right, Angles, and in the bottom, Saxons. These are two Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons. Now, there's Saxons on the continent as well, but they, because of the separation of the waters geographically, kind of go their own way, and the Angles and the Saxons eventually merge into one larger culture. So you got Anglia, East Anglia, West Anglia, those kind of, and then you have the Saxons form like West Saxony is Wessex, East Saxony is Essex, South Saxony is Sussex, and these places that you'd find in the map today in England. Even the word England is from Angles. English is English. So, when we speak about the English peoples, we're speaking about those Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons, that came to the east part of the island and pushed the original British people to the west part of the island. And so the original British people there, like Patrick's people, got pushed over, and they become the Welsh and those Gaelic peoples up there in Scotland and Ireland, where the Angles and the Saxons resemble more the Germans in their heritage and background and language, which is what we're all talking about today, because Beowulf is an epic written in Anglo-Saxon. Now, it almost didn't reach us. There's only one manuscript of this large poem in the world. Remember when we talked about the Bible, the New Testament, being transcribed by copyists, and that the New Testament has the most manuscripts of anything in the world. This poem, which has now been published and translated and studied, has only one. And if that one had perished, we wouldn't have it. It almost did perish. In the 1700s, it barely escaped a fire. I'm glad it escaped so that we could have it today. That would have been tragic. Would have been lost forever. And so, it is an epic poem. An epic, what is an epic? Okay, it's a long poem, right? Kind of tells a story. What epics have you read? Okay, you've read one. Homer's Odyssey. And of course, Homer also has the Iliad, right? This is an epic like Homer. It's a hero tale. It's a hero adventure. There's another kind of epic that you'll learn about next year in Humanities 2, a secondary epic that John Milton has in Paradise Lost, which Virgil also have in the Aeneid, which is, according to C.S. Lewis, when one event becomes a kind of a encompasses all of reality, or means of seeing all of reality through one event. In Milton's case, when Paradise was lost. This is not that. This is an adventure. It tells a long story and a big story as a long poem. And students enjoy it. And so I'm happy that I can sign it today. Let me talk a little bit about some of the creatures you'll meet in there. There's Grendel and Grendel's mother. Grendel's a guy. Well, I don't know, kind of a guy. It's kind of weird. The poem says he's descendant from Cain. He's part of the curse of Cain, which incorporates, there's a lot of, like, there's Old Testament allusions occasionally brought in, but they don't seem to be very closely tied to the Old Testament at times. This is one of them. Cain's descendants were destroyed in the flood, and Cain was a human being, and this monster is doesn't appear to be human, and yet it's described as a descendant of Cain. So is it a giant? Is it an ogre? Apparently, I read one book that was borrowed to me. There's like a relief, a stone relief in England somewhere that has a picture of a man engaging a creature with little clawy arms. Beowulf actually rips off Grendel's arm and brings it back to Hrothgar, back in his hall of Heorot. And so this picture, if you look at it, this relief, it looks like a Tyrannosaurus Rex kind of creature coming after Beowulf or whoever it is that's fighting, going to rip the arm off. And so it's been curious to me whether these creatures in this book, the later one, the dragon, of course, is serpent-like. It's actually called a varm, a worm, we would call it. The old meaning for worm is snake or serpent, and not just like the earthworms out in their yard, something that's, you know, a snake or a serpent. So that dragon or worm, very at the end of the book, is very ominous and numinous almost. And so these dragon tales and stories of slaying the dragon and clearing out a Grendel and Grendel's mother, these monsters that eat up people, it makes me think of how creatures that are very violent get pushed back out of areas that when civilization comes. So civilization is just now coming into these areas through the Germanic tribes, but the wild creatures are still around. Now, I'm treating it as if there is some literal basis of the exaggeration in the book. There's a lot of exaggeration. I don't know how long that Beowulf can hold his breath underwater while he's fighting all these sea creatures and different things, but I do think there's a basis for it, though, in reality. Michigan is known as the Wolverine state, and yet there's no Wolverine in it. California has a grizzly bear on its flag, but there's no grizzly bears anymore. California, they've been pushed out. in the Bible, you read about lions being in Palestine. Well, there's no lions there today. They've been pushed out. And so that's just a natural tendency, is to push out the very violent creatures. And just so if dragons are around, you would kill them off. You get rid of them so that we could actually go to Heorot Hall and enjoy a good evening and go to bed without being afraid of being eaten in the night. The Bible talks about two creatures, Behemoth in Job chapter 40 and Leviathan in Job 41, that strongly resemble dinosaurs. And they live in the time period of man in the early centuries. And so the Behemoth looks like a sauropod, has legs like cedars, or a trunk like a cedar, tail like a cedar, excuse me, and huge legs. Definitely not a hippopotamus or something of that. And the Leviathan is fire-breathing. And so I think these creatures, Leviathan shows up many times in the Bible as a creature in the Psalms, just out there sporting in the ocean, in the deep sea, as a sea serpent. That these are creatures that either God made as they were, or they then were morphed and changed into more ferocious, violent creatures due to the flood. But these are real creatures, and it looks likely to me that dinosaurs are actually dragons, and speak of the skeletons of now extinct animals that, like the woolly mammoth, is usually pretty well accepted today, got hunted out of extinction. And so those 15-foot-tall elephants, I mean, that's such a shame, but I can just imagine when you were Native Americans thousands of years ago here, how much food for your family would be in one of those big guys. And they apparently preserved them by putting them into underwater pits, the carcasses. So that's an open question on this. You might want to just keep that in the back of your mind as you read the exaggeration. Obviously, it's an exaggeration. Beowulf himself has superhuman abilities to be swimming 7 days at one point, and with a full mail of armor on, I think, at another point. And it's just a superhuman. So let's see. Another thing is, be aware. Third thing. The language of here is very strange. I mentioned it's Anglo-Saxon. One of the actual letters is called a thorn. So if you will look, we're going to look together on page 68. And the middle of the page, it has, it's the part that begins with, looks like hate da erla hlio. It will be line number 1, 2, 3, 4, 1035. You see the numbers on the left. Go down to line number 1035 in the poem. Starts with hate, and then a ja or da erla hlio. The erla, I think, is earl, like Earl of Sandwich or whatever. It's an English lord name. If you look in the middle on the 1037 line, it looks like a P, but it's got a big stem on it. That's a thorn. It's a TH sound, so vera, something like that. Vera anum stot. So like there's something like a stead or a place, I think, something like that. That thorn is a TH letter. So there are some funny letters in here. And then, but there are some words that are actually the same. So if we were in a classroom together, we would kind of hunt these down. But you see the word, if you look, the translations on the opposite page, it starts with, next the king ordered 8 horses. Do you see the phrase 8 horses in the Anglo-Saxon? You see that eta Meiros. I hope you recognize what word we would get from Meiros, horses, in Anglo-Saxon. We get mare, right? Which is a female horse. So 8 mares. If you'll notice, saddle shows up on line number 1038. Saddle, swerumfa. As well as, sword, I think, is sverda in 1040. So this gives you a feel. If you say, what words in English today have an Anglo-Saxon basis? Here we have some horses, mares, saddle, sword, earl. These are all Anglo-Saxon words. God is going to be one, and god, which is good. And I've often wondered if God came from like the good one. God is good, meaning they come from the same word. It's fascinating study to do this etymology, where do words come from. And so whenever you want, as you read this, you can dip over there, see if you can find some of the words that you're reading. I think it'll make your, it'll kind of spice up your reading a little bit. Now, there's actually, let's go a little bit more to the meaning or worldviews. These are surface things, language translations or some of the creatures or form of literature. But let's go more deeper into the perspective of the poem. We have two cultures here. The story actually is of Scandinavian cultures. Hrothgar and his hall, where Grendel and his mother are wreaking havoc, is in Denmark. They're Danes. And the history of Anglo-Saxon England, the Danes actually were a big menace. They were a powerhouse in the area, and they caused the Angles and the Saxons a lot of trouble in the 10th century, the 900s, until a compromise was kind of worked out in the 11th century. And so you might call them Vikings. They're Danish Vikings, but they're warriors. They love their culture is a warrior culture, and they operate on the basis of feudal vengeance and avenging wrongs. At one point, it actually says in the book that it's better to avenge a wrong than to spend your time being sad about the family member you lost. Turn that energy into going to hunt down the man that cut down your relative. And so this blood feuding that just is an endless circle is part of their culture. It's a very warrior and bloody culture. Well, the Geats, which is another people, live in southern Sweden, and Beowulf is a Geat. The book ends by this ominous feel that the Swedes are eventually going to take over the Geats. And they're going to be either disappear or be subsumed or something. But the man who's writing the poem is an Anglo-Saxon writer. And so he's using these stories of his own heritage back in the continent. Or somehow these stories, these pagan stories have come to him. And he is crafting these stories into a literary masterpiece. But he himself is Christian. Now, maybe he's not born again, but his culture is Christian. His orientation is Christian. He incorporates the Old Testament and regularly speaks of God, not the gods. This is very unlike Homer, where all sorts of gods are being elicited. And it's not like the European Germanic tribes didn't have gods. I just got done reading the other day about Boniface. I think it was in the 8th century. Or early 9th century, cutting down the sacred oak of Thor. He's the so-called apostle to the Germans on the continent, and they regarded this oak as being a sacred tree, kind of like the Canaanites had their Asherah poles and sacred groves for their god Thor. And he cuts it down, and nothing happened to him, as part of the effort to bring them to Christianity. And so, they have gods. But the telling of this story is in terms of the Almighty, the one God. There's one place in the book, early on in the poem, where the writer describes they, and at times he actually uses the first person I for me, where if you look on page 13, he says, sometimes at pagan shrines they vowed offerings to idols, swore oaths that the killer of souls might come to their aid and save the people. Significantly, that was their way. Their heathenish hope. Deep in their hearts, they remembered hell. The almighty judge of good... Now here's his Christianity coming through. The almighty judge of good deeds and bad. The Lord God, head of the heavens and high king of the world, was unknown to them. Now he's going to cast Beowulf in talking in terms of God, one God, and it's almost confusing at times, because early in the books he's saying they had their heathenish hope. And so unless it's an earlier time period before even this, but scholars and the translator himself says basically the story is pagan, but the retelling of it is Christian, which is very intriguing. So even a word like weird, that's an Anglo-Saxon word, and it means fate originally. Like everybody is going to succumb to fate. In this book, though, that word normally refers to something that God has ordained by his will. And you run across statements like this on page 71. Past and present, God's will prevails. And then on page 193, and there's many of these, this is just a sampling of it. On page 193, what God judged right would rule what happened to every man, as it does to this day. It doesn't alter, he says in a previous line, the Almighty's will. That is very Christian. If you look at the pagan Greeks, even the gods had to succumb, from what I understand, succumb to fate and couldn't get beyond it. But not in Christianity. What happens is what God wants to have happen. As the psalm says, our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. And so this view of the world is a Christian view of the world, where God's will reigns and everybody's going to die because that's God's will. God has ordained it to be so. So this makes this poem really interesting then, more than just a piece of literature, more than just a piece of our heritage as English speakers. This makes it actually a theological test piece. What is the author trying to do? And here's something really intriguing. The translator notes that the references are only pretty... Maybe it's debated at one point, but pretty much only Old Testament. That the God being presented here is the Almighty, and that Christ is not mentioned. Jesus is not mentioned, and yet you have a Bible being used with Cain being cited. And so, what is the significance then of it being even an Old Testament perspective, more tightly defined than just Christian perspective? Well, I want to back up a second and kind of give you a brief overview of the story. On its surface level, the translator calls it agones, from the Greek word struggle. We get agonize, agonizomai, from that. There's three agonies in this book, three struggles. There's Grendel, Grendel's mother, and the dragon at the end. And at first glance, it really feels anticlimactic for the end of the book to have the dragon. Because the first half of the book is just powerful. There's big boasts. Beowulf makes these claims, and this Unferth guy says, you're just empty boasting, and I heard this story that you didn't win on the swimming contest. And then Beowulf explains, I did win. I just had to go kill a bunch of sea creatures. And so, no, I'm really powerful, and I'm going to take this Grendel guy down. He ultimately doesn't use Unferth's own sword. It doesn't work for taking Grendel's mother out. And there's these big clashes going on. It's like really exciting. All this, big celebrations going on in the Warriors Hall. And there's blood and gore. And wow, it's just exciting. And then he goes back to his own land, becomes king, some other stories are told of this people and of this queen who's going to marry this guy. And then 50 years later, he meets this dragon. But rather than the boasting, now it's kind of like he has a kind of a sadness come over him. And so it doesn't feel like it's rising to this big, yeah, he's going to take the dragon out now. Woo, listen to the hero go. All of a sudden now he's not talking as much. I mean, there's still strong statements, but it doesn't seem the same. It's not buoyant. It's not jubilant. It's not young. He's old. He's an older man. And so what is this? And it was interesting that when the translator, in reading the introduction, as the translator says, the real meaning of the poem and its use for us today is found in that extension to the dragon at the end. Because the monsters at the beginning, he calls them, or whatever you want to call them, Grendel and his mother, the monsters at the beginning, they display the physical might of Beowulf. But there's something different about the dragon at the end. He's not a monster from without. No, the dragon is right there all along within the realm, down deep. There's something, the dragon represents something that is with us at all times, but is scary to think about. Something that you don't want to disturb, just let it be. But a guy rips off a gold cup, from the dragon and stirs the dragon into action. And so Beowulf has to go after the dragon. That contour of a story reminded me of Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel in the Bible, where David, the youthful man who goes after Goliath, that's one tale of victory. Defeating this superhuman, as it were, or just large human, 9-foot-tall giant. But 2 Samuel has him facing guilt. That's a whole different kind of struggle. It's a struggle close at home. It's a struggle of his own creating. How is he going to overcome it? And the problems that he has brought into not only his own house, but his own realm. It's this form of a story, I think, that makes it a Christian story. It's that form of a story that we find in the movie Up, where the beginning of the story is Mr. Fredrickson going to fulfill Ellie's wish, his dear wife that departed, that someday we're going to go to South America, to Paradise Falls, and we're going to live there. And it pictures that kind of American, fulfill your dream, do everything you can to fulfill your dream. And which is very selfish. And when he does, he meets up with his childhood hero, who actually is a murderer. And when he gets his childhood dream fulfilled, and has his house parked next to Paradise Falls, he finds out his wife didn't want it after all, but just wanted him to be happy and enjoyed their time together. And he discovers that the relationship with the boy is actually where life is about. That movie, incidentally, I'm told, is written by Christians, by a Christian. It's a Christian form of story. It takes the normal story of hero glory or live out your dreams or believe in yourself, but then reframes it, repackages it in a larger story that brings in the gospel because of the limitations that are built into the success of that initial story. Now, some of this is speculative, but let's just see. I recognize the pattern. It's called a type. In Greek, a tupos. And so let's go with it. If that's the case, then the author seems to be saying that glory is not necessarily found in getting rid of Grendel and his mother, but in getting rid of the dragon. And that the dragon at the end, though taking care of the dragon makes Beowulf himself perish, that somewhere wrapped up in that is the larger glory. Not the other ones, which is temporal and in this realm. And so death, it appears to be, sin and death appear to be the larger problems. The dragon illustrating death and the blood feuding illustrating sin. Those stories that are told at the end about this woman's going to marry this prince, and these two people through marriage are now going to be reconciled. The author goes, I don't think so. They're going to be at war with each other again. You're not going to get rid of sin that easily. That hopeful thinking of reconciliation. Sin is a deeper problem. And then the statements about death, that death comes to anyone. Spoken on page 67. Death is not easily escaped from by anyone. All of us with souls, earth dwellers and children of men, must make our way to a destination already ordained where the body, after the banqueting, sleeps on its deathbed. Death is inevitable. Sin in this world is inevitable. Our solution has to be bigger than this, from somewhere else. But this book doesn't tell us the solution. It only brings up our hope for glories. Oh, I could be a Beowulf someday. I could take out the dragon or take out the monster. I could clean up this city of this particular vice. I could create this vaccine and do something great. The end of the book shows, yeah, you can get the victory, but eventually things will return back to normal. Eventually all the gold gets put in the burial or put in the ship and sent out. Eventually the Geats themselves disappear. Eventually sin and death continue on this earth. What's the purpose of such a statement then? I believe it's like Ecclesiastes that says, vanity of vanities, a breath of a breath, everything here is a breath, and takes away all our hope of finding some kind of significance in a breath, so that we're left to conclude, well, if that's the case, meaning must be somewhere else than this world. And as C.S. Lewis famously described, if I find within myself a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most reasonable assumption is I was created for another world. Or in the language of Ecclesiastes, if I find that everything in this world is a breath, but within me God has put eternity, which is opposite than vanity, literally in Hebrew, a breath, then eternity must be somewhere else than in this world of chasing after wind. And so Beowulf can get his victory, but larger meaning has to be somewhere else. Do you see it with me? Like Ecclesiastes in the Bible, Beowulf, brought into a Christian context, says Beowulf can have his fame, but there must be something bigger out there. There must be another world out there. And right after he described how they had their heathenish hope, on page 15 he says, but blessed is he who after death can approach the Lord and find friendship in the Father's embrace. I think that's the most hopeful gospel statement I've found. To use the word Father for God is very New Testament. After the resurrection of Christ has made clear the immortality found in Jesus through justification, freedom from our sins, by his sacrifice, we can have God as our Father and a hope that extends to a new life after death. Well, see if that resonates with you as you read the poem and come to the end of it. May your mind be expanded beyond just the excitement of killing a dragon, as it were, or killing the monsters, though enjoyable as that is to read. Let me just talk a little bit about your assignment then. It's really cool. On page 29, which is XX1X in the introduction, he has a description of how Anglo-Saxon poetry works. Your notes has it as well. Each line of Anglo-Saxon poetry has two halves. Each half has exactly two accented syllables. So if you've been with us in Greek, you know the accent is the hard beat, right? You know, ba-boom. And so there's only two booms, two big syllables on each half. So each line has four, two per half. Those accented syllables, what those syllable, the sound that those syllables begin with, then forms the second feature, which is alliteration. So there has to be a repeat of one of the sounds on each, in each of the halves on an accented syllable. So the sound could be found on the first or the second boom in the first half. If it's properly done, it's going to be found on the first of the two accented syllables in the second half. Though sometimes it can be improperly done and show up on the second. You could even have it on all four. And so he gives some examples there, but let me give you mine in the notes first. In the dawn of day, King David attacked. And so D, D, King David is a D, attacked, K, K, is the fourth one. Number two, a weird one arrived. So weird and arrived are the accented syllables with a word from the wise. So word, wise, weird, W sound is alliterated. The child on his bike, so ch, and then b, hit a bump and then flipped. In this case, we have the b of bike and the bump, the b of bump, that match up. On his page, he has examples in translation. The fortunes of war favored Hrothgar. The highest in the land would lend advice. You can see the repetition of the L sound. The third example, and find friendship in the father's embrace, where F is then repeated on in the two halves. Part of your homework is I want you to come up with a four-line poem. Each of the lines would have a half then that is structured in this Anglo-Saxon two beats per half with an alliteration found in each half on an accented syllable. If you have a question about this, please give me a call. I look forward to your creations and to hearing your retelling, reading your retelling of the epic poem Beowulf. Thank you.